Welcome to Unpacking Peanuts, the podcast where three cartoonists take an in-depth look at the greatest comic strip of all time, Peanuts by Charles M. Schulz.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. It's a very special day here in Unpacking Peanuts where we're looking at Charles Schulz's very own favorite storyline that he wrote for Peanuts. It is the Mr. Sack sequence from 1973. It's very famous, beloved, and I can't wait to talk to my pals about it. How are you all doing? You doing well? I hope so. My name's Jimmy Gownley. I'm your host for this evening. I'm also the cartoonist of Amelia Rules, The Dumbest Idea Ever, and Seven Good Reasons Not to Grow Up. Joining me, as always, are my pals, co-hosts, and fellow cartoonists. He's a playwright and a composer, both for the band Complicated People, as well as for this very podcast. He is the original editor of Amelia Rules, the co-creator of the original comic book price guide, and the cartoonist behind such great strips as Strange Attractors, A Gathering of Spells, and Tangled River. It's Michael Cohen.
Say hey.
And all right, Willie. And he is the executive producer and writer of Mystery Science Theater 3000. A former vice president of Archie Comics, and currently the creator of the Instagram sensation Sweetest Beasts, it's Harold Buchholz.
Hey, hello.
All right, guys, so we're looking at the Mr. Sack sequence. This is a special episode where we're just going to look at one storyline in depth. Before we get to that, we have some listener mail I could read to you guys. Would you be interested?
Please.
Yeah.
All right, cool. This is from Barbara Castleton, who wrote about our earlier 1973 episode. Barbara writes, I was out of the country when these strips were published, so I'd never seen them before. You and Michael both. This is a new experience for so many of us. Still, I'd seen Snoopy in many guises, but never snarky with a touch of malice. April 4th was palpably sad, with Linus reminding him of his absent friend and Snoopy showing us how well he knows Woodstock and all his idiosyncrasies. I wonder if Schulz ever had friends who tried to dissuade him from being focused on a chosen project. Anyway, I was greatly relieved that Snoopy decided to catch Woodstock up on what had happened so far in War and Peace. It takes no critical thinking to get that silly thing start wars, whether in Russia, a family, or a backyard. And that's from Barbara. Well, thank you, Barbara. What do you guys think? Do you know that experience she asked about, though, whether he had friends that dissuaded him? I've never necessarily heard anything about that, but I'm sure there are elements of that in his life. What do you guys think?
Oh, everyone is always supportive when you say, I want to be a comic book artist when I grow up.
And they go, you do it.
Oh, you can make as much
as
some poets.
That's a great idea, son.
Yeah, so he probably did.
Well, it's funny. I mean, that just takes me back to that story that we recounted from when they were doing the Christmas special. That's like the one story I've heard where other people told Schulz trying to be, have his mind changed about things, about a laugh track and this sort of stuff. And yeah, how Schulz, like, he leaves the room and then like, oh, let's never speak of this again. You know, like it never happened. You know, it just shows what, number one, how strongly Schulz felt about things, but also how much people respected him, as they should have, right?
Absolutely.
I can't remember. Did cartoons have laugh tracks in those days?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
God, that's horrifying.
Oh, yeah, it really is.
I mean, not all of them. Obviously, you know, you don't have like Hermie the Elf telling a joke and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and going,
yeah, but you have the, you know, people laughing to the Flintstones, the live studio.
Yeah, Flintstones,
yeah, Flintstones, yeah. Had it. Yeah, yeah. Boy, all those yucks and Johnny Quest. No.
For a second, I thought you were serious. I was like, really? That'd be amazing. Johnny Quest with a laugh track.
Oh, Bandit.
Oh! Yeah, I'm certain he had a couple of those. But, he, you know, clearly, his superpower was being just completely built for this particular job. And I don't think there was any force on earth that was going to dissuade him from it.
Yeah. He had this, given all of the doubts that you see in the strip, one thing he never seemed to doubt was his ability to make right decisions with the strip. Although, you know, he showed that he was concerned about like what the editors might think and what the readers might think. Actually, could I read a little thing he said? He wrote this to Cartoonist Profiles, which was an amazing kind of insider magazine for mostly cartoonists or people really into comics in 1971. And he was describing the changes in the strip and his sensitivities to, you know, how he thought that might not always go with everybody, but he was taking some risks, and that it might shed some light on where he was in this period, and particularly, you know, this thing we're about to read with Joe Sack in it.
Fantastic.
Okay. So this is Schultz. Yeah. Writing to, I think it was Judd Hurd, who was the editor. He said, "I think the Peanut strip itself has changed considerably during the past 5 years." This is in December of 1971. "I'm probably using fewer gags than ever before, and I'm depending on the personalities of the characters to carry the strip. I've learned also to trust the faithfulness of my readers, and I certainly never expect to please each one every day. I have learned to take the risk of using ideas that might be regarded as too, quote unquote, in, knowing that those who understand the idea will be flattered and will appreciate it by showing even more attention to the strip than they did before. Perhaps the most in idea I have ever used was the one where Snoopy was pulling the sled up the hill, and when Charlie Brown looked down at the sled, he saw that it was named Rosebud. I also love to do things that are really kind of silly, like using terms such as queen snakes and gully cats, but realize that this is very risky, because if readers are caught in a mood where they do not appreciate silliness and do not see it in this way, the whole thing is going to collapse. But I am convinced that these risks are worth taking, and I am fortunate in having editors at United Features Syndicate who are willing to go along with this kind of thing." So I thought that was really interesting, given what we've been talking about when we've been seeing these shifts in Schultz. And obviously, Schultz was very aware of what he was doing and where he was going with this. And, you know, the idea that he loved silliness, we've seen that from the very first year of the strip. And sometimes he indulges himself more than others. And I think he really has kind of gone into this space where he's enjoying it. I think adding Woodstock in some ways really was, you had a character where Snoopy and Woodstock in their own little world could just kind of go off in these areas of silliness, and we'll see it all the way through the end of this 50-year run. But the idea that he loves silliness, but he was aware that maybe it doesn't always ring right with certain audiences, he was also aware of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, it's very hard. I mean, it's basically a unique thing in the case of Peanuts, where such a large audience had to be accounted for, you know, hip people, square people, highly educated people, kids who are in kindergarten. Michael, do you remember, like, particularly, I guess, in the 60s, what at the height of, like, say, the counterculture, which was also the height of Peanuts, was there ever any kind of cognitive dissonance with this thing being cool while at the same time having to speak to so many different types of people?
I don't think the counterculture embraced Peanuts. I was kind of on the fringe since I was still in high school. Yeah, I mean, the underground comics were starting, and I think they were pretty much trying to get as far away from this kind of storytelling as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just trying to be outrageous. So I don't know. I have a feeling Schultz was probably considered kind of, you know, stodgy.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of like his attempts to be hip, like, you know, he mentions there, you know, these hip references like Citizen Kane, you know. It was right in gear with what me and my friends were into.
And you were slightly younger than that. Yeah.
Well,
that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, it was sort of intellectual, and it was kind of slightly depressing strip, which we appreciated. And he wasn't going for laughs as much in the 60s, I don't think.
It's funny that you should say that, because I'm looking here at the David Michaelis book, which I have, you know, slandered and stuff on our episodes. But I will talk a little bit about this. He does talk a lot about this particular sequence, the Mr. Sack sequence that we're going to talk about, but he also talks a little bit about some of the stuff that was going on in the strip previous to this, and the testimonial dinner that Charlie Brown was supposed to have given to him, and then all the other kids decided it was hypocritical, so they back out of it, which we discussed in last episode or the episode before, something like that. So a fan wrote to him and asked about that very topic, you know, why Mr. Schultz is essentially such horrible things happening to Charlie Brown. So I'll read from Michaela's hit here. Why, Mr. Schultz, asked Mr. Robert B. May of Oroville, Ohio, occasioning a long defense of the melancholy in Peanuts, which concluded, this is from Schultz, actually, I am very fond of Charlie Brown myself, and I don't like to see him hurt. I'm afraid, however, that a happy comic strip is almost impossible to draw and would be as unrealistic as a completely happy and carefree life. That's the end of the Schultz quote. And then Michaelis continues, happiness, he insisted, was not a source of humor. In this observation, he echoed Tolstoy, who wrote that happy people have no history. So there you go.
And yet there's a whole element of Peanuts that lives, that is about happiness.
Of course. Happiness is a warm puppy, for goodness sake.
Yeah. I mean, right. So it's interesting that Schultz in the strip is saying, maybe that's not where I need to go. But when you extract it from the strip and it to me, it's like these other things of Schultz are almost like are memories of the strip. You're using the memories of the strip, yes. Or you're extracting these iconic elements of the strip. And that, I mean, I think he was asked to do the happiness thing. I don't think he came to somebody necessarily and did it, but
he put it in the strip first, though.
Was that, yes, like, but we were talking that was about the era of the Hallmark deal. So I'm not exactly sure where it falls. It's like the things were being asked of him that were a different version.
Well, no, I'm pretty, Peanuts, I do, right? Want to be clear. No, it did start in the strip with that happiness is a warm puppy strip.
But I think it also, if I recall, we noticed that it seemed to be lying on top of now doing greeting cards, which is a different world, right? You're trying to capture
I completely think if someone from the greeting card world would see that and go, oh, that's great, you know, or not even card, it was a gift book world,
or he's being asked, yeah, right, the gift book people were responding to Schultz, who might be responding to Hallmark by thinking through ideas. The fact that he was doing the little happiness at some point, the little happiness stamps, which was a thing that existed back when he was growing up reading comic strips, you'd often get these little collectible stamps that were in the Sunday comics that a cartoonist would do to try to kind of keep somebody coming back to read the thing, and you'd have these little character stamps or this and that, and he chose to do that with the happiness. But yeah, I could be totally wrong. It's all conjecture, but I'm thinking that maybe the happiness thing, he got there because he was having to translate Peanuts into greeting cards. It just seems like that's where those ideas might have come from, since they hadn't seemed to have been there before that part of his life existed.
Absolutely. You know, this is Schultz's favorite story. And I will read one more thing from the Michaelis book here, where he talks about how he sort of came up with it and what his thoughts were on it. This is from the Michaelis book called Schultz and Peanuts, and it's the chapter called Happiness. And this is a quote from Schultz. I thought of the idea while working on a Sunday page. Instead of the sun rising, I drew a baseball on the horizon in the title panel, which is dropped by most newspapers. I worked on the idea and just thought of things as I went along. Then 2 years later, Schultz wrote, I don't know which story has been my favorite. And I believe this is actually originally from that Peanuts Jubilee book. I don't know which story has been my favorite, but one that worked out far beyond my expectations concerned Charlie Brown's problems when, instead of seeing the sunrise early one morning, he saw a huge baseball come up over the horizon. Eventually, a rash similar to the stitching on a baseball began to appear on his head. And his pediatrician told him it would be a good idea if he went off to camp and got some rest. Boy, they really just wanted to put kids off to camp in this trip. Because he was embarrassed by the rash, he decided to wear a sack over his head. The first day of camp, all the boys held a meeting, and someone jokingly nominated the kid with the sack over his head as camp president. Before he knew it, Charlie Brown was running the camp and had admiration of everyone. I don't pretend there is any great truth to this story or any marvelous moral, but it was a neat little tale and one of which I was proud. And then he could never explain where the idea came from. It just happened. All right. So that's kind of set up for where we are. We're going to do the thing where we looked at this as in-depth as we can while skirting copyright laws. So I'll read a few of them and then describe some others and then read a few more. And we'll go like that. That makes sense?
Sure.
Sure.
All right. So if you characters out there want to follow along, this one's going to be pretty easy. All you got to do is either pull out your beautiful Fantagraphics books, go to your gocomics.com. If you're doing that, you want to type in June 11th, 1973, and then away we'll go. June 11th. It's the pre-dawn hours, and Charlie Brown is lying in bed. He is, however, wide awake. In panel two, he rolls over, still wide awake. Panel three, he tosses back, and we see the sun just beginning to peek over the horizon. And in panel four, we see, in fact, it is not the sun, but it's a baseball. I think it's really interesting that the initial spark of an idea came from him having to do one of those symbolic panels of a Sunday page where he knew most paper would just throw it away. Mm-hmm. I think that's interesting that his magnum opus would come out of something that was, again, something he was forced to do rather than really wanted to do.
Yeah,
that's true. Just those things, you have to learn to read them as not being part of the strip.
Yeah.
If you try to analyze those first panels, you can go crazy because anything can happen in that first panel. So yeah, so this is a wacky idea. This is pretty much as surreal as things have gotten so far, I think.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. But it's a little, but it's a more contained surrealism than, say, the Head Beagle thing. Like, talking about the speech Snoopy made where there was the riot and all that kind of stuff. That seems a little more chaotic and a little less, I mean, believable is not the right word, but, well, I mean, kind of is the right word.
Well, yeah, right. It's being there's a television. Right. It's being televised. I mean, what world is going on in Peanuts? We're having to expand our minds into what this surreal
world is. Well, the only way
become.
To read this is that he's gone crazy.
Yeah, he's cracking up, and he has, and if he's manifested physical symptoms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then once it becomes.
He's not actually awake.
Or yeah, he's right. not, at this point, yeah, it could be he's not actually awake. That's true.
Yeah, but if he's manifesting real symptoms that other people are seeing, which is something that he's commonly now doing in Peanuts, where the surreal is being experienced not just by the one person, like, you know, let's say early Snoopy when he's Snoopy and the Red Baron. It's like everybody's now aware that something's going on in his world that's inexplicable, mm-hmm. right?
Which brings us to June 12th. Charlie Brown, with unerringly bad judgment, decides to go and talk to Lucy about this. So we have Charlie Brown sitting at the psychiatric help booth, and he says to Lucy, "Yesterday morning, I woke up very early. I just couldn't sleep. My bedroom faces east, and so I could see the sun coming up. Only it wasn't the sun, it was a huge baseball." Charlie Brown continues, "I think I must be cracking up. I think I'm finally losing my mind. And on top of it all, I feel terribly alone." In the last panel, Lucy has apparently invited him to the other side of the psychiatric booth. And she says, "Okay, now tell me more about this huge baseball." I think that's actually very kind of Lucy. That she invites him over to the other side of the booth.
Why do you think she's invited him to the other side?
Because he's feeling terribly alone.
Oh, so you think it's that is a kindness of Lucy? That's the only reason.
I do. I feel like he's feeling terribly alone. Like, okay, now you're not terribly alone, which I just think is really cute, and it's kind of kid logic, and it does give this little, you know, like going back to what William Pepper said, there is more to Lucy than just meanness.
Well, it's funny. I didn't read that in that was her response to feeling terribly alone. But that it makes total sense, but I didn't read it when I read the strip that was Lucy's solution of his loneliness was that he's now on the other side of the booth.
Yeah, I didn't understand her response at all.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I just thought she was really interested.
Oh, no, he's terribly alone. Now he's not alone. Yeah.
But you have to add the illogic to it to make it her logic. So yeah, I think you're right, probably. I mean, that's the most obvious answer, but it didn't strike me that way when I read it.
Well, this continues going on, and the next day we see Charlie Brown sees the moon has now taken on the appearance of a baseball. And the next day, Sally, who very nicely, again, it's interesting, people are trying at this point to like be nice to Charlie Brown. Maybe they realize he's cracking up. Sally offers him an ice cream cone, but when he gets it, it too looks like a baseball.
Now, I have the feeling that Schultz is just jamming here. Like, he doesn't know what this is leading up to.
100%. Yes, he states that in somewhere, either that thing I read or someplace else, where he just made was making this up as it's going along, which is a fun way to work. I've worked that way many times. I think the best things I do, I work that way, but it's also a really risky way to work.
Well, at some point you might have to just throw logic away to get things back on track, which he does.
Yeah, he'll sometimes do that. It makes me think of animation. That there's two kinds of animation. There's most people do pose-to-pose animation, where you know the extremes of a character, and then you draw the in-between drawings to get there.
Yeah.
But there's also what's called straight-ahead animation. And there are a few masters of that animation where literally you just draw the next drawing and the next drawing and the next drawing and the next drawing. And it's you know, it's considered much more dangerous. Yeah. as an animator, but certain animators can really come up with some crazy stuff that you wouldn't otherwise, because there are no side rails as you move
right
forward.
Yeah, right, exactly.
It can get pretty crazy.
Yeah, well, this is a real important mode of storytelling, where you don't know what's coming next. And actually, some of the greatest works, or some of my favorite works, were written this way, surprisingly enough. No. Especially Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings, yeah.
That's the best example. I could not believe it when I heard that Tolkien actually did not know what was going to happen next.
Well, this is an interesting question. I don't know if you guys have ever addressed this or seen this in Schultz's description of how he worked. He was obviously responsible for putting out a strip a day, and he more or less kind of seemed to be, you know, I've done my strip, okay. And he had to do 7 in a week. He's probably working 5 days a week, but he had a path to do this, right? Do we know to what extent Schultz, if he was working on something like this, you know, because usually if I'm sketching something out or I've got an idea, I'm going to follow that through, and I might write 10 or 12 strips within, you know, a couple of hours if something's got a flow to it. And you do know where it's going, and you can kind of tweak it. Do you think Schultz was actually at some point just saying, okay, I'm done for the day. Now I'm going to think of something else on this story tomorrow. And then I'm going to think tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. And he is just kind of figuring it out as he's committed to a finished script.
I think it's like,
first I thought you were going into a Shakespeare monologue there. Tomorrow, yeah. Tomorrow, and tomorrow. Yeah. Creeps in this petty pace.
No, I see this as Charlie Brown's cracking up. He's seeing these things everywhere. So he takes that as far as he can go as a gag. And then he picks it up with the natural consequences that he has to go to the doctor.
Right. Which brings us now to June 15th.
Yeah.
Charlie Brown and Linus are hanging out at the Thinking Wall. Charlie Brown looks distraught. He says, "Everything I see looks like a baseball to me. And now my head has started to itch. I think I have a rash or something," he says, as he scratches his head. Linus says, "Turn around, let me look." He does turn around, and in fact, he now has a rash in the shape of baseball stitches on the back of his head. And Linus says, "I think you'd better see your pediatrician, Charlie Brown."
So here's again where some characters' surreal concepts somehow pull themselves into the reality of the strip. So now Linus is seeing it. He actually has the same thing. There's no explanation for this other than there is a surreal.
Well, there's psychosomatic. This is a surreal
psychosomatic. Yeah, he's manifesting the symptoms. You know,
but I'm just saying, like in our world, if I was dreaming about a stitches or a baseball, I don't think I would get a rash in the shape. You know what I'm talking about? It's like
I don't think it would happen very often. No. I don't think
but it does happen.
Schultz has no idea that he's going to put a bag over his head and go to camp. That's what
I. So think. you don't think he was working ahead?
I don't think so.
It seems bizarre to me that maybe he did. I mean, that he would. If he has like a 4 week strip sequence, he's going to take 4 weeks to figure it out. He's not going to work ahead or come up with 8 amazing ideas that he's got to write down. And now he knows where he's going. I don't really have a record of him saying one way or the other how that would typically work. Do you guys know baseball well enough to know why the stitches are that way? Is it some physics thing that if the pull or the tear or the whatever force that's put on the ball, if it's in that shape, that it's less likely to tear apart?
Well, I think it has to do with cutting a piece that you can roll up into a sphere.
A sphere, yeah. And it'll never be changed because that's how pitches are p- pitched. It's entirely about how you put your fingers next to the stitches. You know, you line them up one way, it gives you a curveball. You line them up another way and flick your wrist a certain way, it gives a drop, whatever. So, yeah, so here we go. So now good old Linus has recommended that Charlie Brown go to the pediatrician. And here we are. And Charlie Brown has, in fact, put a sack over his head to hide the fact that his head now looks like a baseball. We see him talking to the desk, which is, of course, representative of the receptionist. And he says, "Yes, ma'am, I have an appointment to see the doctor." "Well, it all started one night when I couldn't sleep and I saw the sun come up, only it wasn't the sun, it was a baseball. Why do I have this sack over my head? Well, I've also developed this rash or something, you see, and..." Ma'am, do we have to discuss this in front of the whole office? I really like that strip. Uh-huh. So why did he put a sack on his head? 1974. When did the Gong Show start?
Or 73.
The Unknown Comic. The Unknown Comic was a pop culture phenomenon of the 70s.
That was later, I believe.
Well, I don't know. That's what I was trying to look up. Let's see. It would be interesting to see.
1976.
Wow, the first appearance of the Unknown Comic was 1970. That shocks me. I assumed it had to have, all my life, I assumed this had to have something to do with the Unknown Comic.
He must have read Peanuts.
He must have read Peanuts. Maybe the influence did go the other way. Who knows? So here's my question that I want to ask you guys about the baseball thing. What do you think the significance is, whether intentional on Schultz's part or not, of it being a baseball that he's seeing?
I'm assuming he was up at night thinking about some horrible thing that happened during the last game.
Yeah. Do you think that, like, that is, if you think of Charlie Brown as a failure, the baseball games are the thing that pop out the most in your mind with that?
Yeah. Well, he's never won a game.
Right.
He's probably never had thrown a strike. Yeah, it's got to be, and it haunts him. So right. I think he is cracking up. And then there's this psychosomatic thing that happens.
Rash.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Harold, what do you think about the fact that it's a baseball that he's seeing?
Well, I'm just kind of fascinated with the idea that Schultz is a person every day who imagines something in his mind and then he brings it to life and it comes into the world in a comic strip. I mean, that's what a comic strip artist does. And here he has his comic strip character kind of realize something that's coming just out of his, what we think is out of his mind, and then it manifests itself. I mean, it just seems like for Schultz, this is what's happening in his life, and so he has it happen in Charlie Brown's life too.
Wow, that's a really interesting way to look at it. June 18th, there's a Sunday in there, and then June 18th, we kind of reiterate that he does, in fact, have baseball stitching on his head. Then he, on the 19th, he goes ahead and he recounts. This is really interesting because you very rarely, I'm going to read this one just because it's a very odd setup for Peanuts. It's a very odd setup. So Charlie Brown is now talking to the doctor. He still has the sack on his head. "Well, doctor, it all started early one morning when I saw the sun come up." We now cut to a flashback where we see Charlie Brown in bed, the sun rising. It is a baseball. And Charlie Brown's VO says, "Only it wasn't the sun, it was a huge baseball." Then we cut back to the doctor's office, and Charlie Brown is saying, "Then it was the moon, and pretty soon everything looked like a baseball to me. And then I got this rash or something on my head, and well," and then the last panel, Mr. Sack says, "Am I cracking up, doctor? Is this the last of the ninth?" I love that he's doing a flashback. That's such an odd thing.
I think he really feels he needs to get the readers caught up. Which comics used to do, mm-hmm. these daily comics, like the first panel was always like, "As you recall yesterday," you know.
Yeah, and it's hard to describe it if someone hadn't read it. They might not take literally what he's saying because it's so bizarre. It's like he has to show it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Boy, it is really hard to think about writing stories in this format, especially like Mike was saying, the adventure strips, especially at this point when there was so little space for them. Panel one would be like, yeah, as you might recall, what happened yesterday. Then panel two would possibly advance the story. And then panel three would tease tomorrow. And that would be it. You'd have really like one panel to advance the story every day.
Yeah.
Is this the last of the ninth? I like that.
So here we go. Now Charlie Brown is packing his bag. This is on June 20th, and Sally is looking him on. He still has the sack on his head. And Sally says, "What are you packing for a big brother?" Charlie Brown says, "My doctor says I should go to camp. He said I have to do something that will take my mind off baseball." Sally, now walking, is behind Charlie Brown as he walks out with his duffel bag. She says, "I've seen you play. I never thought you had your mind on it. Thanks a lot. I'll see you in 2 weeks," says Charlie Brown. Then, calling out after him, Sally yells, "You're going to be a big hit at camp carrying your head in a sack."
Wow. So Sally is being a little prescient here. And Schultz does this so much in the stories where characters will predict something unlikely,
yeah,
and then it happens. I've noticed he does that a lot. Or characters will, like the big strip, I think, from 1973, the big sequence about that testimonial dinner. There's like three different jokes about, or what's the fundraiser for?
Right.
And it's like there's three different jokes about it being for some minor ailment, because they usually were doing things for
stomach aches or whatever.
Right. You're for the National Heart Association or something, you know, and he's going to be about stomach aches. But it's like, I don't think it's the same character making the joke. It's like everyone is saying the same joke like three times as if it was so obvious in that. But in this world, and here Sally is kind of guessing where it's going. I think that's really interesting that Schultz does that. He lets the characters kind of set us up for what's about to happen.
Absolutely. All right. So I think that's a good place to take a break. We're going to go get a quick snack and maybe a delicious beverage, and then come back on the other side and we'll talk to you about more Mr. Sack. In the meantime, if you want to help us out, you know, while you're getting your snack or whatever, you can log on to our website, unpackingpeanuts.com. That's where you can go and you can buy some of our books, because we're all working cartoonists and we'd love for you to read our work. You could buy a t-shirt. There's two different caricature versions and one of the Be of Good Cheer slogan with the 914 radio pen nib. You can also buy us a mud pie or support us on Patreon. So why don't you guys think about doing that while we go take a break, and then we'll be right back. And we're back. I missed you so much. June 21st, we see Charlie Brown, still wearing the sack, on the bus to camp. "So here I am on a bus going to camp," he says. Panel 2, we see the bus. A wide shot of the bus. And Charlie Brown continues, "For someone who hates going to camp, I sure spend a lot of time there. Maybe I went to the wrong doctor." In panel 3, we're now back close in on Mr. Sack / Charlie Brown, as he says, "Every summer, he drags his family off on a 5-week camping trip. His solution for everything is go to camp." In the last panel, Charlie Brown continues, "I know what'll happen to me. Just when I get old enough where I won't have to go anymore, I'll get drafted into the infantry."
I think Schultz is a little insecure about this. I think he's over-explaining it. He's a little worried that readers are not going to buy this.
Interesting.
He usually will not, like panel 3. To get into the doctor's motivation,
yeah,
is a little weird.
Do you think? Yeah, because he is buying himself a little bit of time too. If he's making this up as he goes along, you know, maybe sometimes you need a day to fill in, just because you have to, you know, put 4 panels in the strip in the newspaper that day. So maybe he just needs to buy himself a little time so he does an explanation strip. But yeah, you're right, to get into the doctor's motivation is pretty weird. What do you think of that drawing of the bus?
It's bouncing along.
That is a really rough drawing of a
Isn't
bus.
It weird? Like, isn't it weird? I do think that there is something personal about this, and it feels like there's something that Schultz is almost struggling to get down. That might not be the right word, but it's almost like it's not just flowing out. Like he describes it. Oh, yeah, it just flowed. I don't think it did just flow out, because that's a weird drawing of a bus. He is explaining it more than he would. I mean, I'm loving it. I think it's brilliant. And I think he's going someplace that's personal and deep. But I don't think it's flowing out. A couple things I think that are interesting is, first off, you don't see any other kids on this bus. You know, the two times you see other windows, there's nobody there. It's just Charlie Brown going with the sack on his head. And you know, Schultz talks about in several interviews that he used to think when he was a little kid that if he got separated from his mom, like no one would be able to identify him or find him because his face was so bland and plain that no one would be able to identify it as anybody specific.
What a unique fear.
Isn't that strange?
That is wild.
Yeah. And here he's doing that.
It's also interesting. I've never seen him sign his name on top of art. He actually, his ass is crossing the window in front of Charlie Brown on the fourth panel.
Yeah. Doesn't it feel it's a little...
Well, I just want to throw something in here. I've been thinking about it in the back of my head because it was something that Jeannie said was that she said, I used to love to drop in on her husband and hang out with him while he was drawing. And he says, it was years later that I realized that takes tremendous concentration.
Right.
But he wanted me to be there and he would converse with me while he was drawing. Mm. And, you know, I know what that's like. And I'm sure you guys know what it's like when you are drawing something and you're trying to lay it down. To do that on top of a conversation or, you know, it makes it that much harder and it's easier to be distracted. And I just think he so enjoyed being around her that this, you know, we hear occasional stories of people would come and visit him while he was doing it. He'd show them what he was doing or he would be working on it. But it's possible, you know, going forward that quite a few of these strips are being done when there's somebody else in the room. And that could also affect, you know, how your strip comes out.
Well, the only time you can really have a conversation while you're doing a comic is when you're inking noodly details. And there are no noodly details in Peanuts, you know? I mean, he's drawing in ink. And it does require a lot of concentration. This brings us to June 22nd. We're now at the camp, and we see one of these non-Peanuts Schultz kids saying to Charlie Brown, who's still wearing the sack, "Don't just stand there, kid. There's a meeting over at the main building." We're now at the main building, and we see a bunch of kids sitting there, including Charlie Brown. Charlie Brown says, "Everything always happens so fast at camp. I never know what's going on." One of the other kids says, "What's this meeting all about?" A third kid with glasses, who actually looks like he might have male pattern baldness himself as a child. He looks like he's rocking the Larry Fine, but with a hat on top. He says, "We have to elect the camp president." The first generic kid says, "I've got a great idea. Let's nominate the kid here with the sack over his head."
I find this really strange. This whole thing is very strange to me. This is, according to this, is Schultz's favorite sequence. Yet, from here on, there are no characters, none of his characters except Charlie Brown.
Yeah. Yeah. So it has to speak to the fact that he really saw Charlie Brown as the center of the strip.
Yeah.
You know, it may be, maybe you would think about this is his favorite Charlie Brown strip. Which is what, in fact, makes it his favorite Peanut strip. Because clearly, Charlie Brown and Snoopy, I think, are the two that are his biggest avatars.
And when you think about what this sequence is all about, it's Charlie Brown leaving his element, which is the strip, and he's going into a world that he normally doesn't go to when he's not affected by the kids in his neighborhood. He's not affected by his dog. And all of a sudden... things change for him.
Yeah.
It is interesting that Schultz, it's almost like Charlie Brown getting to kick the football in this sequence.
Yeah.
He gets these moments of when he's outside of his normal world, which is the strip. Normally, all of a sudden things change for him. Things get better for him. And it is so funny. When I also think, again, in terms of the timing, I mean, this is when he's just about to get married again, right? Mm-hmm. And there is this kind of new beginning for Charlie Brown in this sequence that Schultz seems to be enjoying dwelling on.
It's very true. It's a really interesting way to look at it. Another thing that's interesting here is if you go over to June 24th, which is the Sunday, we see, presumably, the thing that kicked this all off. Which is, although it is not directly tied into the Mr. Sachs storyline, we do see the throwaway panel where Charles Schultz drew the baseball as the sun coming up in the first panel. Yeah. All right. So the kids have, in fact, elected Mr. Sachs president, and they've decided to call him Mr. Sack. And so now we're on June 25th, and we see Charlie Brown in his new role as camp president. And a little kid runs up to him and says, "Hey, Mr. Sack." Charlie Brown says, "Mr. Sack." The kid says, "Remember how I told you I couldn't find my shoe? Well, I did like you said. I looked under my bunk again, and there it was." Kid runs away with a big smile on his face, saying, "You're a good camp president, Mr. Sack." "Mr. Sack," says Charlie Brown.
I like the eyebrows on the sack.
I don't think I ever noticed that.
Well, it's so funny that we had a sequence not too long ago where just the very idea that two girls had a fight over Charlie Brown at the camp across the lake led the camp leadership to toss him out on his ear. And here he is walking around with a sack over his head, having been elected camp president. And, you know, there's no repercussions from the adults.
The shirt would be a giveaway.
Well, maybe it's a different camp.
Yeah, they're not wearing sailor hats.
So sure. Oh, no, the next day.
And it's co-ed, too.
It is co-ed,
this is his first co-ed
camp. So you know what? It must be. Because, yeah, only one kid's wearing a sailor cap. So I think you're right. I think this is a different camp. On June 26th, we see some more non-Peanuts characters talking about how he did well. Well, let me read this one. It's tough to decide which ones to read and which ones not to read, but this isn't a kind of important one, I guess. So we see a freckle-faced little Peanuts, non-Peanuts character saying, "You know, Sack, that wasn't a bad breakfast." And Charlie Brown is sitting next to him, putting the food up in the sack. The kid continues in panel two, making a grossed out face, saying, "I was here last year and the food was terrible." Kid points at Charlie Brown saying, "I'll bet you straightened them out, didn't you, Sack? I'll bet you told them to shape up on the food here or ship out, didn't you? You're a good camp president, Sack," the kid says as they take their trays back for cleaning. Charlie Brown just blankly looks out at us through the sack. This is an interesting, like, psychological phenomenon. You know what I mean? Like, it really does say something about human nature. That now they're just going to put all of their hopes and dreams and the positive vibes on this kid with the bag over his head.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't ring true with human nature, I don't think.
Oh, really?
I mean, I wouldn't say, "Oh, isn't this the way things are that this kid," I mean, if he was doing it in jest, you know, I could get that. But the fact that he thinks that this kid with a sack over his head is just because he's enjoying his meal is responsible for his improved culinary experience.
Well, to me, though,
the humor is because it is surreal, right? It's not that it's like, "Oh, isn't that human nature?"
Well, to me, I think for Schultz, it's he has gotten a lot of praise and a lot of awards and a lot of whatever from a lot of people who he probably felt didn't understand him. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Did I ever tell you that when I was a little kid, did I tell this story about making the Peanuts drawing for my grandmother? Have I heard this, told this story?
Yeah, go ahead.
So I was like 5 years old and I used to make these drawings every like season for my grandmother. Like, it's spring has sprung was this one, right? And I drew all the Peanuts characters playing around outside. And I remember all like her and my aunts were fussing over it. "Oh, you're so talented. It's so good." And then they said, "It looks almost as good as Charles Schultz." And I was, you know, just so proud. And then one of them said, "Oh, no, I think it's better." And I melted down. I had a complete meltdown. I was crying. And basically because I realized, all this praise is a lie. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They can't be better. Even at five, I know that's not true. So why are you telling me this?
This realization that someone is going to lie to you.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was heartbreaking, right? Even though it meant that they meant well, of course.
Right.
You know?
Sure.
And it's possible I was slightly oversensitive.
And it's possible it was slightly better than Schultz.
Possible.
At the age of five.
Pretty good. No, but you know what I mean? I think that's what he's seeing.
Future New York Times bestselling graphic novelist.
Oh, brother. All right, here we go.
Oh, wait. I do want to say I love the character in the very last panel on the right-hand side who's behind Charlie Brown.
He's kind of a snob.
What a great-looking, great little throwaway character.
And he shops wherever Schroeder shops, it looks like. He's.
Yeah, those are hand-me-ups.
And I'm not going to read this one in its entirety, but it is important because we have Charlie Brown, who is now writing home to his parents, and he's interrupted in the middle by a kid who needs a little bit of advice about which type of class he should take. Charlie Brown doles out the advice, much to the kid's joy. And the upshot is Charlie Brown writes home to his parents, "Life here in camp is wonderful."
Aw. That is quite a panel in the history of Peanuts.
Isn't it? I mean, it's really amazing. It's amazing that he gives him this moment. It's so poignant and sad that it's not him. It's Mr. Sack. You know, it's a beautiful thing. And the next one, this is great because here we go, June 28th. Now this, I'm sure there'll be some obscurities and some explaining to do with this one. This is a good one. Charlie Brown and one of the little non-Peanuts kids is sitting out there and they're fishing. They're fishing with sticks and string because this is a very cheap camp. Mr. Sack says to the kid, "Years ago, there was a cartoon drawn by Frank Wing about fishing." Mr. Sack continues, "This boy was helping his dad hoe the garden, and he said, 'Gee, Pa, I'll bet the fish are biting good today.' And his dad said, 'Uh-huh, and if you stay where you're at, they won't bite you.'"
I mean, the cool thing about Peanuts fandom is, of course, they found that strip. And if you go online and you want to search for Frank Wing and Schultz in this sequence, do a Google search, just pop in some of those words, you can find exactly the comic that is being referred to. And it's cool that it's an old, old comic. And Schultz is remembering that comic here for this.
Yeah, show. And it's clear that at this point, Charlie Brown is completely just being an avatar for Schultz.
Right, yeah. Because, I mean, Schultz studied with Wing and joined him on the faculty of the art instruction schools. So he was very close to him. It's really nice that he's kind of honoring him here. And he must be, but he's probably remembering that strip in his memory, right? Because the actual wording is not too far off. It says, "G-Paw, I bet you the fish, F-E-E-S-H, are a-biting great today." And Paw says, "Uh-huh, well, you stay where you're at and they won't bite you," is the actual.
I see.
So, yeah, it's I think it's cool that he's honoring Wing. Frank Wing is kind of, there was a style of cartoonist that is largely forgotten today. They were really big in like the teens and 20s and into the 30s and early 40s, who did these kind of Americana, Norman Rockwell-esque comics. H.T. Webster did a bunch of stuff like this. I'm trying to think of the other cartoonists who did these styles. They were often single panels, and they kind of were capturing this old Americana, small town, rural world. And Wing was a master at that.
Beautiful stuff. So, you know, Charlie Brown goes on as Mr. Sack, continuing to run the camp well. He points out the two kids are fighting. Another kid goes over and stops them. But Charlie Brown, as Mr. Sack, still gets the credit. Then here on June 30th, the same kid, it's really this curly-haired kid that has been hanging out with Mr. Sack a lot. They're looking out at the stars, and the kid says, "Mr. Sack, which star is the North Star?" Charlie Brown says, "Well, do you see those two stars that make the end of the Big Dipper? Just follow them straight up six paces, and there's the North Star." "That's amazing," says the kid. "Being with you, Mr. Sack, has been the greatest experience of my life." Charlie Brown walks away and says, "A prophet is not without honor, save in his own country." And the other kid says, "What did you say, Mr. Sack?" Which brings us to the point of the strip, of the sequence, rather, is that Charlie Brown, removed from his Charlie Brownness, actually is someone who has great depth, has great competence, is a good friend, is all these good things.
Yeah, he knows about the North Star. Actually, in this case, he actually is sharing some information that someone finds valuable, and that's really cool. And he's, you know, he's quoting scripture as well. You know, that seems like a very Linus thing to do, but here we see Charlie Brown doing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, because it's a very Schultz thing to do, right? And this is Schultz being this is Schultz under the sack in some ways. I really do think so.
Yeah, that's yeah. I think you're right.
But now here we are on July 2nd. We see that, in fact, his head doesn't seem to itch anymore. Maybe the rash has gone away. And he's contemplating taking the sack off. On July 3rd, in fact, he does take the sack off. We see he's waking up early. And we just see him pulling his shirt on over his head as his little friend wakes up and says, "Psst, Mr. Sack, what are you doing up so early?" But now Charlie Brown, with no sack on his head at all, says to the kid, "I'm going out to watch the sunrise. If it's the sun, I know I'm cured. If it's a baseball, I'm still in trouble." The little kid watches him leave and says, "He didn't have a sack over his head. He is our camp president." And suddenly he is... he's back to being Charlie Brown again. He sits in the dark. He waits for the day to come up. And here's the big conclusion. July 5th. It's getting light. The sun is coming up. Charlie Brown covers his eyes and says, "I can't look. I can't stand the suspense. But I have to look. I have to know. Will I see the sun or will I see a baseball? What will I see?" Panel 3, we see he finally pulls his hands away from his eyes. He looks. And in panel 4, instead of the sun, we see Mad Magazine mascot Alfred E. Newman saying, "What? Me worry?" And Charlie Brown just says, "Good grief."
Oh, man.
So what do you think about that, Michael?
The Alfred E. Newman?
Yeah.
It looks like he traced it.
He probably did, right?
Yeah. It's not in the Schultz style at all. I don't know. This is not my favorite sequence.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that, you know, Schultz said something about it didn't have a message, but it seems the message to me is that it was his face that's been holding him back his whole life, which is something you can't do anything about. It's sort of like all his problems are caused by the way he looks.
Well, I think of that as being symbolic. It's all his problems are caused by him being Charlie Brown. And he is a bald kid at age 8, you know? So, I mean, I'm sure there is a weirdness factor to it. But I think what it is just, to me, it's like that mask allows him, you know, the same way like a superhero would wear a mask, right? It allows him to be something else to people rather than his mundane self, which is constantly ridiculed and picked on. I mean, as we see, like you said, as soon as the kid sees his real face, he's like, forget it.
I don't know if that scans, because the kid nominates him for camp president solely because he's got a sack on his head.
Right.
Which has its own meaning,
right? He hasn't said
right?
anything or done anything to earn this honor.
Well, he did. He's wearing a sack on his head. I think that, I mean, that is what it is.
It made him stand out.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. You think about the idea of wearing a sack as a statement, say in 1973, that's a fashion statement. There's something bold about that. There is something to wearing a sack and sticking with it.
Mm-hmm.
That is, I can kind of see, I can't see the adults accepting it, but the kids accepting it, it is a kind of a strange thing that I could kind of get from what I remember, what it was like to be growing up in 1973. There was just a lot of change, a lot of uncertainty, and it was the idea of making statements through fashion, your own thing it strangely kind of does flow with the times. And the fact that it ends with Alfred E. Newman, it's interesting that he puts "What Me Worry" over Alfred E. Newman. It's like he needed a little help, I guess, for get people to where he was going with this strip. He wanted to get as many people over the finish line as he could. But once again, I mean, Schultz is like right on top of the zeitgeist. There were 2 years that Mad Magazine had a circulation of over 2 million copies, and it was in 1973 and 1974. So once again, Schultz is just right on the pulse. And just for some reference, there was no other comic book or comic magazine that was even half that. It was Mad Magazine was its own phenomenon in this era. And the fact that, you know, we had brought up the thing that no other cartoonist characters had ever appeared in a Peanut strip before. And then of course this is the other one, the other exception that I know of, where we actually do see Alfred E. Newman showing up in a Peanuts strip. That's a big deal, you know, that Schultz is allowing Alfred E. Newman into his world to be the final punchline of this long sequence.
Well, it can, to me, it is proof of my my hypotheses of Schultz is a character in Peanuts. I mean, I think this is absolute proof. I mean, who would make the sun look like Alfred E. Newman Charles with lettering Schultz above its head? It's Charles Schultz. Right. And who would put Charlie Brown through this thing? It's Charles Schultz, you know? And it's weird because it's almost like, and by the way, like he'll know if he's crazy or not. And what he saw was the icon of mad.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, that's not encouraging. Right.
Well, I would love to know at what points Schultz knew where this was going. You know, did he go all the way and then sit and noodle at his desk the very last day? And that was like, because I think if I were Schultz, I would be really questioning this. Is that made him laugh, but it's like, can I pull this off? Can I actually get away with this as my the final joke in this long sequence? He must have thought it was pretty daring.
Yeah, it is daring. I mean, I don't know that I love it as a punchline. I love it as confirmation of my theory.
Well, there you go. Well, no, I think I would go along with you on that. I think I just love the breeziness of Schultz doing things like this in the 70s. He seems to be in a place where he's willing to, like he had just said, you know, a couple of years earlier and a little less than 2 years earlier in that interview that I read from, that he liked silliness. And, you know, I see it in the letters that he writes to his friends in like the 40s and 50s. He would go to places that he wouldn't go to in the strip. And now I feel like he's allowing himself a side of himself that he questioned as like, is this something really that's going to be accepted that he really wants to put in the strip? And he's letting himself do it. And I am grateful that he's gotten to this place as a creator and as a person in his life, that he's willing to be silly, because I love silliness. I think silliness is grossly underrated. And I'm really grateful that he's messing around. It doesn't always hit. And like he said, you know, if someone's not in the right mood for silliness, they will trash whatever you're doing as the dumbest thing ever, right?
That's right.
But he is at a place where people know him and his characters, and he's willing to do that. And there's, I think, silliness and joy somehow can go hand in hand. And, you know, Michael, you were talking about how, you know, the strip was depressing. We're kind of going away from that sometimes in these silly sequences where he's just kind of expressing this surreal joy in certain strips. And yeah, he doesn't always take you there, but sometimes when he does, it's transcendent. It's just this lovely moment where you're just kind of dancing with Schultz and having fun, and it doesn't make any sense. It's just silly and it's fun.
And yet, but there also is a sadness to the whole thing, because Charlie Brown has experienced this thing and he's never going to experience it again. And like, you know, Schultz pulling this like little gag on him at the end, showing Alfred E. Newman, is kind of like saying that, like, well, this sequence is over, buddy. Now you got to go back to the strip. I always like those things where you take the character out of their element and see what happens. And to see Charlie Brown become a success.
Yeah.
For whatever
reason. But it happened. It happened. I mean, that's what I'm hanging on to here. It happened.
I think that's really cool. And it's not a fantasy sequence, and it's not going to be taken away as like, you know, the baseball game where they won, but turns out rerun.
And I have to say, the first panel in the sequence, if for those of you who are following along, this is July 5th. The first panel is lovely. It's Charlie Brown kneeling in this black ink underbrush of what, you know, an unmanicured area of a camp. Really, really beautifully drawn. And he's kneeling kind of expectantly in there. That is a really pretty panel. And he draws Charlie Brown really well there. And yeah, I love that panel of expectancy. And
he does make an artistic error in the second panel, which is really rare for him.
What do you say?
Oh, it's just that the line of the sleeves it look like it's his head.
Oh, it's a tangent. Boy, that's really interesting. Yeah, so what Michael's talking about here is they're called tangents in art. It's where one line continues against another line that are actually unrelated. So what Michael's talking about here is the curve of Charlie Brown's bottom jaw goes right through and becomes the curve of his sleeves, right? That's what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Which makes it look as if his head is actually kind of, you know, crossing planes with the arms.
Yeah. Now, I didn't notice that the first time I read it, but it's...
Right. It is something, though, that I am always fighting against in my own drawings, actually. I think maybe it is because when it's simpler, too. It's more obvious, you know, because there's fewer lines. Mm. Michael, did you read Mad? I know not in the 70s you didn't, but were you a Mad fan when you were a kid?
Yeah, it'd be the late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah.
So I was surprised when you said its sales were that high in the 70s, because this was sort of when National Lampoon kind of became the hip satire mag to read.
Yeah,
I don't know if people were still reading Mad in those days.
Well, a little or
so, like younger people were. Yeah. Just for context, like in 1960, the circulation was just over 1 million, and then it pretty much just grows steadily every year until you hit 74, 2.1 million copies, which in the world of comics was unheard of. I mean, at one point, I think maybe back in the 40s, Captain Marvel might have been pushing 2 million.
Yeah, I think Captain Marvel had higher circulation than that.
But this in this era, at this time, there's no comic book, because essentially Mad Magazine became a magazine because of the Comics Code, which came out in 1954, where there was essentially an outcry about the content of these comics, which people were saying were for kids, but everyone was reading them at that time, adults as well. And so they toned back a lot of the content to a very strict code, kind of like the movie code and the Hays Code in the 30s through the late 50s. And so Mad Magazine survived by stopping being a comic. It went black and white. It had been in full color and the size of a comic book, but they switched over and said, okay, we're not a comic book anymore, so we don't have to follow your comic rules. And it thrived, and it outsold any comic book by a long shot at this point.
Yep, absolutely. So there you go, guys. That is Mr. Sack. Do we have any other final thoughts on this before we kick it to next week?
He doesn't really resolve it. No. I mean, he's still crazy.
Yeah.
But then it's dropped. So I was kind of surprised when I saw the next strip, couple of strips, and it's back to Peanuts Land without any follow-up.
He's still sadly, sadly crazy. But that's okay. We all are.
Yeah, and it's, and like you say, I do believe, Jimmy, that you're right, that this is Schultz showing his hand in the strip in a distinctive way at the end. Mm-hmm. Which maybe it's not my favorite gag either. It's a bit of a non sequitur, but I'm glad that we're seeing Schultz popping through the strip at this particular moment in his life, given what he's just taken Charlie Brown through. It's been a very unique few weeks of Peanuts, and I'm grateful for that. You know,
yeah, exactly. That's basically how I feel about it. Very much. I think this feels like a very, very personal sequence for Schultz. It of course confirms my pet theory, so I love it for that reason. And since it mattered to him, it was important for us to take a good look at it. So that's it though for this week. That was Mr. Sack. Join us next week when what are we going to do next week? Oh, we're going to talk about Peanuts and how good it is and that we like it. So if you want to listen to some of that, you can come back next week. In the meantime, here's what I want you to do. I want to hear from you, because it's so nice to hear from you guys, and I worry about you when I don't hear. So you can email us through our website, unpackingpeanuts.com. You can follow us on social media. We're Unpacking Peanuts on Facebook, and we're at Unpack Peanuts on Twitter and Instagram. So you can do those things. You could also call us on the hotline, and the number is, hang on,
717.
Wait, I could do part of it. 717-219. And what's the rest?
4162.
There you go. 717-219-4162. We would love to get, you could send us a text message, or you could leave us a voicemail. Other than that, just come back next week and listen to our show.
And correct all of our egregious errors, please.
Yeah. Because we don't know what we're talking about. We're making... Oh, but I'll tell you real quick. You listen to things, you see things on the internet, and you go, oh, well, they must know what they're talking about, right? I Googled something the other day about Paul McCartney playing bass left-handed. And in this context of the article, it says, Paul then saw a photo of Slim Whitman on the internet playing the guitar left-handed. So in 1956, Paul McCartney saw Slim Whitman on the internet. So you can't believe everything you hear online, people. And that is the type of research we try to bring to this podcast.
We need to have an all yodeling episode.
Well, that's what we'll do next time. But until then, for Michael and Harold, this is Jimmy. Be of good cheer.
Yes.
Yes.
Be of good cheer.
Be of good cheer.
Unpacking Peanuts is copyright Jimmy Gownley, Michael Cohen, and Harold Buchholz. Produced and edited by Liz Sumner. Music by Michael Cohen. Additional voiceover by Aziza Shakrala Clark. For more from the show, follow Unpack Peanuts on Instagram and Twitter, Unpacking Peanuts on Facebook and YouTube. For more about Jimmy, Michael, and Harold, visit unpackingpeanuts.com. Have a wonderful day, and thanks for listening.
What? Me worry?